Let's continue our look at the events of Good Friday, the day on which Jesus atoned for our sins, by opening to Mark chapter 15, and I want us to kind of scroll back and begin at verse number 8 in a moment. Jesus has been presented by the Roman Sanhedrin to Pontius Pilate as a person guilty not only of crimes against the Jewish people, but crimes against Rome itself, that he has claimed to be the king of the Jews, a capital crime if it were true. They had intended that Pilate would rubber stamp this and that Jesus would be on the cross in a matter of minutes after they handed him over. But Pilate, for whatever reason, has decided to evaluate matters for himself. And he keeps coming back to the idea that there is no evidence for Jesus being guilty of a capital crime from Roman standards. He even sends him to Herod Antipas, and Herod comes to the same conclusion and sends him back. And so finally, Pilate tries to manipulate the situation so that he gives the Jewish people a choice for his annual Passover amnesty, where he releases someone currently in prison back into Jewish society. And he manipulates it by offering them either this Jesus of Nazareth, the one who is known by some as the King of the Jews, or you can have Barabbas, a murderer, a troublemaker, someone that is not good to be released back into Jewish society. But the Sanhedrin, they do their own manipulation of the crowd. I'm not sure how they managed to do this. Some people suggested they might do bribery. Others said that they used strong-arm tactics. Perhaps they just used the power of their authoritative figures. But somehow they got the crowd there at the front gates of the Praetorium, the Tower of Antonia, to demand that Barabbas be released. And so that's Mark 15, verse 8. The crowd came up. They began to ask Pilate to do as he usually did for them. That's the annual amnesty. And he answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews?" For he perceived that it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. But the chief priests stirred up the crowds to have him release for them Barabbas instead. And Pilate again said to them, "Then what shall I do with the man you call the King of the Jews?" And they cried out again, "Crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him." And so Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, because as the other passage said, he felt that a riot was about to ensue, released for them Barabbas. And then, having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Now, Pilate's already washed his hands to try to get the crowd to agree publicly that he is not the one making this choice to release Barabbas, that he's not the one making the choice to crucify Jesus. They are. But it becomes clear as the story progresses that Pilate really doesn't want to crucify Jesus still. And so he does something that I believe was intended to arouse the pity of the Jewish crowd, or at least satisfy somewhat their bloodthirst. And that is to scourge Jesus horribly and to mock him. And so Mark chapter 15, verse 16 says that the soldiers led him, meaning Jesus, away inside the palace. That is, the governor's headquarters. This is the Tower of Antonia, which was an impressive palace structure on the north, slightly west quarter of the Temple Mount. It was originally built back in the time of the Hasmoneans. It was a fortified palace, and therefore it became, for the Romans, the perfect place to run security at the Temple Mount and at Jerusalem as part of their responsibilities. So Jesus is led back inside there. No Jews attend because they're all staying outside because this is Gentile territory and it would make them unclean ceremonially. And that's not something you want to do on the day that the Passover lambs are killed and butchered, eaten. These Roman soldiers call together the whole battalion. The word that's used here in the Greek language represents about 600 soldiers at least, about a tenth of a full-strength foot soldier legion. This might represent the regular contingent at the Antonia Tower. 600 soldiers would be more than sufficient to run security there in Judea during most occasions, including Passover time. So what did they do? They basically have a guard mount. They gather all of these Roman soldiers together in the central courtyard, probably. And then they clothe Jesus in a purple cloak. More than likely, they're taking their cue from what Herod Antipas, the Tetrarch of Galilee, had already done. He mocked Jesus by putting kingly clothing on him. So they put a purple cloak on him to kind of pretend that he is royalty. And then they twisted together a crown of thorns and they put that on him. And then they began to salute him. Hail, King of the Jews! And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him. And the other passages make it plain that what they do let me just read that. This is John chapter 19. Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. That's the scourging with the cat and nine tails, probably embedded with some bits of metal or bone. It would have ripped up his back into hamburger and also done damage along his buttocks and down his legs and on his arms and shoulders. And so they did all of that. And then the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns. They put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" and struck him with their hands. They were also pulling reed out of his hand. They'd kind of given it to him as a scepter. And then they'd smack him over the head with it. And they were also, back to the Mark account, Mark 15:19. They were striking him on his head with a reed. They were spitting on him. They were kneeling down in homage to him. So they're doing all of this to make fun of him. And he has been beaten badly. Like I said, his back is probably hamburger at this point. He's not been able to sleep since the day before because he didn't sleep at all last night. He's exhausted. He's dehydrated. And now because he's bleeding, he's dehydrated even more. So he is exceptionally weak. He has been punched in the face and slapped around by the Jewish guards when they had him in their custody. So his face is probably puffed up and bruised. He's probably got the beginnings of a pretty bad couple of black eyes. The prophecy passages from the Old Testament indicated that his beard would have been plucked out in certain places as part of the torture process. They would have been ripping at his beard. So he is an absolute mess. And then John tells us what Pilate does next, which is what tells me Pilate was intending to present him as a pitiable, beaten, weakened figure that didn't really need to be executed. John chapter number 19, verse 4. Pilate then went out and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no guilt in him." Here we are again. We're back to it. He has repeatedly told them this, even when he caved into their demands. Now he's back to saying, "I'm going to bring him out to you one more time so that you can see him. I don't believe he's guilty of a capital crime." So verse 5, Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, which is probably blood-soaked all along his back and shoulders. They can see that he is a mess with his face, his beard in patches. And Pilate said to them, "Behold, the man." Effectively saying, this is the guy that you're so afraid of. This is the guy that you don't think you can stand living. Now, when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Because that's their goal. That's been their goal the whole time. They've wanted him dead at the hands of the Romans, and Pilate is dragging his feet. And so Pilate said to them, "You take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." Now that verse sounds all the world like Pilate has decided not to go through with it, even though he's clearly agreed to it earlier. I mean, he washed his hands and all of that and said, "You guys have to take responsibility for what's about to happen." But it seems like he's back to, "I am not going to crucify this guy when he is not guilty of a capital crime." Verse number 7, the Jews, and specifically the Jewish leadership here, the Sanhedrin, answered him, "We have a law. And according to that law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God." Now we get back to the Jewish accusation that he is guilty of blasphemy. Now it's not blasphemy if it's true, which it is. Jesus is the Son of God. But from the Jewish perspective of the Sanhedrin, it's not true. And therefore, it is a capital crime by all Jewish law. Now, the effect that this statement has on Pilate is of note. Verse 8, when Pilate heard this statement, that is, that he, Jesus, claims to be the Son of God, he was even more afraid. Remember that his wife sent him that note earlier, saying that she had had a dream. Romans believe that dreams come from the gods, from the divine world. And in her dream, she had suffered greatly because of him, because of Jesus. And she told Pilate, "Don't you have anything to do with him?" The Romans, many of them are believers in the mythology of the Greeks and the Romans, that from time to time the gods interact with humans and half-human, half-god demigods are produced. These are the sons of God. And so there is room in the superstition of Pilate for the possibility that he could run across someone that is half-god. And so the moment he hears this, that makes him even more frightened about how he's caught in the middle of this untenable situation. Verse number 9, he entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus. So he leaves the front of the praetorium, the place where he's got his seat set up, probably on a little high platform just outside the front gates. He leaves there and goes back inside to his own little office. He takes Jesus with him. The soldiers are taking him back in. And he sits down and he starts talking to Jesus again. He said to him, "Where are you from?" Now, he's not specifically wanting to know a town, because he's probably already been told that. He's from Nazareth in Galilee. He's thinking more of what's your origin story? Are you one of those half gods? But Jesus gave him no answer. Now, I've shared with you before, when Jesus is in the presence of the Sanhedrin during this whole Roman phase, he doesn't talk to Pilate. But when he's away from the Sanhedrin, he has talked to Pilate every single time until now. Now he doesn't answer. So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have the authority to release you?" Notice that he puts that first. That's where his emphasis is. "Don't you understand? I could give you freedom at this point. And I also have the authority to crucify you." And so Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above." That's the principle we see in Romans 13, right? That there is no human government that did not come into power without the active or permissive will of God being exercised. So Pilate is prefect because God let him be prefect. Pilate has the authority of life and death because God permitted that circumstance and situation. And then Jesus finishes with this, "Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." The reference there, I believe, is a reference to Caiaphas, the high priest of the Jews, and the pretty much the leader of the Sanhedrin. He is the official Sanhedrin representative. And so he's the one, Jesus says, has the greater accountability. Which, because he should have known better. Verse 12, "From then on, Pilate sought to release him." So Pilate is definitely wanting out of this circumstance, this situation, because of what his wife said to him, because of the fact he's looked at the case, he knows there's no capital crime from a Roman standpoint. This is all Jewish stuff. And he also is worried that Jesus is somehow tied into the supernatural world. And so he wants out of it. So he goes back outside, apparently, and tells them, "I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to execute this man." But the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. You are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." Now that is the final straw. That is what changes everything. Let me explain to you why. And this is not original to me. I have actually seen this in other teachings elsewhere. Paul Meyer, I give a lot of credit to for really expanding on this concept. Pontius Pilate was promoted to this position of leadership, this prefecture, during a time when Tiberius Caesar had ceded a lot of his decisions over to a man called Sejanus. He was the master of his horse, I think. So he was a high-placed military commander. And this Sejanus was using all of that authority in order to set the stage for a coup so that he could become the next emperor of the empire. But that coup fell apart. Sejanus was killed, executed, and there was a huge purge that shot through the Roman world, centered at Rome and Italy, but it reverberated elsewhere. This all happened in the latter part of the year AD 31. So we're only a year and a half or so beyond that. And so the only way, probably, that Pilate escaped being caught up in that purge is because he had been appointed so early in Sejanus's administration of these matters, and also because he was stationed so far away from Rome. I mean, he's clear out in the eastern end of the empire. But there was always going to be this cloud hanging over Pilate's head that he was a Sejanus appointee. Well, that cloud just started looking very threatening. When it says here, you are not Caesar's friend, the implication is you are not acting like you believe Tiberius is the one in charge. We're going to report you to Tiberius. And so Pilate would have been terrified that this information would have possibly colored him as part of that original coup and gotten him killed. And so verse 13 says, so when Pilate heard these words, that tells us this is the decision point, he brought Jesus out, so back out into the front, and then he sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the stone pavement, and in Aramaic, it's called Agabatha. So this is probably a decorative plaza that's right in the front of the Tower of Antonia. I believe that the arrangement between the Temple Mount was this. The northern wall of the temple complex probably was separated from the southern wall of the Antonia Palace Tower by a good broad street. And this section of it was probably very decorative. There were at least a couple of bridges that went over the top of this street that connected the temple complex with the Antonia Tower. And so somewhere in this decorative part of the street, this is where Pilate has set up his judgment seat so that he could deal with Jewish matters out in the open where they wouldn't be ceremonially made unclean. So he has now come to that place, brought Jesus with him, and he is ready to make his final public declaration. Now, John tells us in verse 14, now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. The word for preparation here is the common word for Friday in the Greek language. The Jewish people used it as the idea of the preparation for the Sabbath day. And this particular Sabbath day happens on the 15th, which is the day, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So it's a very particularly high Sabbath. John then says it was about the sixth hour. Now that's our English Standard Version and all pretty much all the other versions out there based on most of the manuscripts. But there are additional manuscripts out there that say the ninth hour. And I think that's the more authentic one. The Jewish people, their hours start at sunrise. So the ninth hour is going to be 9 o'clock in the morning or mid-morning. And the other texts tell us that's when Jesus was crucified. So it's almost that time. John tells us. Almost. That's when he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." And they cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" And Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Now, they will rue the day they said some of these words, because they don't really want Caesar to be their king, and they also don't want to take accountability for the blood of Jesus. But Pilate gets them on the official record here that what he's about to do, he does because they want it. And so he then delivered them over to them to be crucified. And the last thing that we kind of find from the other passages is that they took him back inside. They stripped him of that royal robe, which had to have hurt, because he's had it on for a little while, and there's probably been the scabbing that had started from the beating of his back. And then they put his own clothing back on him, and then they began leading him out to the place of crucifixion. And when we come back tomorrow, we will talk about the potential locations of Golgotha, or Calvary, the place of the skull. Because I think there's two very decent possible locations. One is on the north side of the Tower of Antonia, and the other one is on the far west side of the neighborhood just west of the Tower of Antonia. And both of those have reasons to be presented, and I'll walk you through some of those ideas the next time we get back into God's Word.